Welcome to episode 4 of our special series, Democracy Optimists, with Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU.
What does it mean? To be American?
Throughout the 2024 election season, we're bringing you conversations with election and voting experts from across the political spectrum so that when you go to the polls on November 5th, you'll get there fully informed about how it all works. Here's Joshua Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. We talk a lot about felon disenfranchisement, which is the practice of taking away the right to vote from someone who is convicted of a felony. And we talk a lot about rights restoration, or giving the right to vote back. Today, we are honored to speak with someone who recently regained her rights and has advocated for a change to the laws, as well as the law student who helped her through the process to have her criminal conviction expunged in Kentucky. Deb Grainer and Claire Sandberg, welcome to Democracy Optimist. So, Deb, we'll start with you. Tell us your story, from the mistake you made way back in 2011 to your push for a restoration of voting rights now.
Well, thank you, Dr. D. I moved to Kentucky at the end of 2008 with my husband, who got a retirement job becoming a tour guide at Buffalo Trace Distillery. We got to rent a lovely house. We joined a church. I looked for work. It was hard to come by any kind of employment. And I suffered from an increasing amount of depression and started drinking rather heavily. And over a two-year period of time, things got really bad for me. And I, in a drunken blackout on Halloween in 2010, I caused a fire in our rental home, and I was, of course, arrested and convicted of arson. It's been a long battle. I finished my probation. Fortunately, I never had to go to – I was never incarcerated. In my court trial case, I was pleaded to a lesser felony. I always get the letters mixed up. I'm sorry, whether it was a C or a D felony. So if I was told if I pleaded guilty, I wouldn't have to go to jail or prison. So I did that. And I finished my probation in the five-year period. It was mostly unsupervised because I'm not really a big troublemaker. I had a bad time and made a terrible mistake. And so when I finished my probation and really realized that I could not vote, I always had before. Back home in Pennsylvania, when I found I couldn't vote, I applied to the governor for clemency, and of course, never heard back from him at that time. And then I found Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, and they had been working on the situation of felony disenfranchisement for close to 20 years now. So I joined them in 2018 because, even though I'm not much of a numbers person, I'll never forget these numbers. At that time, it was out there that over 310,000 Kentuckians were not able to vote because of having a felony in their past. That equaled 1 in 10 of voting age people. And for people of color, that was 1 in 3.
Wow. And, you know, Kentucky has one of the strictest laws in the country. And Deb, I love your bravery in openly sharing your story in an effort to explain what happened and also to try to help people. So in 2019, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear granted voting rights to thousands of people convicted of crimes. And Deb, you were one of those people who got your right to vote back. What was it like to vote again in 2020? What went through your mind when you voted?
Well, it was really kind of a particularly stressful time for most of us because it was right in the beginning of mid-COVID. So we had filed for absentee ballots because we didn't think we were going to go into to vote in person. I spilled coffee on mine. And so I went to vote in person And they saw that I had an absentee ballot, so they weren't going to let me vote, or we had to sort it out. Fortunately, the county clerk was there. I had met him in the past. And I went in there, mask on my face, and I got to vote. And I forgot my camera, my cell phone on the way in. So Mr. Hancock took pictures of me voting. So that was wonderful. It was a very freeing feeling and healing. Although I knew, like you said, the work's not yet done because there's so many other folks out there that were not in that 140 to 170,000 people that were affected by the Governor Beshear's executive order.
Mm-hmm. Claire, you're a third-year law student at the University of Kentucky, Rosenberg College of Law. I haven't had the pleasure of having you in class, but we've interacted a bunch in the law building. And I know you're also enrolled in the legal clinic at the law school and worked on Deb's case. How did you first hear about Deb's case and take her on as a client?
Yeah, so I first heard about Deb's case through the clinic at UK. Third-year law students are permitted to take real cases under the supervision of the director of the legal clinic, Professor Delora Hughes. And so I was a student in the fall, but Professor Hughes saw that I had an interest in continuing to help with pro bono cases over Christmas break. And when I heard about Deb's case, I was really excited about the idea of helping someone expunge their record before the new year.
So let's make sure we understand what's going on. So, Deb, you got a restoration of voting rights back from the governor's order in 2019, but you still had a felony conviction on your record. So Claire's work was to try to get that conviction expunged, right, to get it off the record. So, Claire, talk about what you did. Walk us through the process to seek an expungement of Deb's record.
Since I have my limited license to practice as a student attorney, I was really able to fill out all of the forms necessary to go through this process. Deb mentioned how it can get a little bit complicated with the type of crime that was committed and the disposition of the case, but there's a lot of possibilities for expungement. So I got some information from Deb to figure out what kind of case we were working with. And then I tried to personalize the care, personalize the work on the forms for Deb and Deb's story specifically. More than just checking a box, we wanted to give information on what Deb did in the past and how she's grown as a person today. And really give a full picture of Deb's story.
Yeah. And so it didn't take that long, actually, for everything to get processed. To kind of walk us through, you know, after you submitted the paperwork, you know, what happened next? What did you hear next?
Yeah, it was amazing. So we started the first week of winter break, and I just went in every day for just a couple of hours. It didn't really take that long. I just wanted to make sure everything was in perfect shape. I got Professor Hughes to look over everything. And then after Deb signed it, we submitted the files to the court, and we weren't expecting to hear back until the new year. I was kind of crossing my fingers that we'd get right at New Year's, but we ended up getting it right before Christmas. So it was a perfect Christmas surprise.
And what was your reaction when you got the notice from the court that the expungement had been approved and that, you know, she no longer had a record?
I was thrilled. I think that it was such a great reminder after a really stressful time during finals and kind of getting lost in the weeds of law school to be reminded of why I do this and really getting to help someone out.
Yeah, it's you know, most people who go to law school do it because they want to serve. They want to serve the community. They want to help people. And so great that you had a chance while still in law school to do that for someone who has really been an advocate for so many others in Kentucky. Deb, what was your reaction when you learned that the expungement was approved?
Well, first of all, my probation was over, or my five-year waiting period after my probation was over in October, and I contacted Professor Hughes sometime November-ish, and I was saying, oh, I was hoping to get this taken care of before the end of the year, and she said she had to wait. She had not received the paperwork that she needed from the Department of Corrections, I think it comes from, or the state police. And so as soon as she got it, I got a call. I went in and had my interview or done my paperwork with Claire. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's Christmas time. We're not going to hear anything. And Professor Hughes called me on December 22nd and gave me the best Christmas present ever. I was just thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
That's great. And Claire, what has this experience meant to you as you're about to embark on your legal career after you graduate?
Definitely. Well, like you said, this was a great experience for me to get real world experience. This was a great opportunity for me to remind myself of why I went to law school. I also think that cases, pro bono cases while you're in law school provides a great mutual aid opportunity. Because yes, we were able to help Deb, but I benefited from this experience as well by gaining legal experience and learning how to navigate a case and maintain the trust of my clients.
Mm-hmm. Now, Deb, you've gone through a kind of incredible journey, right? From, you know, the depths of despair that occurred in 2010 and then the conviction in 2011 through getting a restoration of your voting rights to now an expungement of your record. What do you think your story means for others in Kentucky? What message would you give to people who are facing similar challenges?
Well, first of all, I think I did put in a lot of work to try to get this all taken care of on my own as well as I could. I was very fortunate to be taken on by the legal clinic, which was awesome because you can go to like expungement clinics and everybody's out in the world and there's nothing confidential or comforting about sitting in a room with a lot of people that are seeking the same end to their criminal history. So what it meant to me was that I was really taken care of kindly, promptly. It didn't need to be confidential, but I felt very protected. I think I still can be a voice and or a face to people who are still waiting to have their felonies expunged, to learn about the need for voting and trying to encourage folks to do that. It's not just being able to get a job or rent a home that your felony can hamper you with. So I want to be out there. Our work is not yet done until we get a constitutional amendment. And so I will keep talking and I'll be the face that I can be to help other people understand that there can be an end to this and it can be very positive.
That's great. Now, you mentioned that you joined the group Kentuckians for the Commonwealth that has worked on the issue of restoration of voting rights in Kentucky. Tell us a little bit about the organization and what it's doing.
Kentuckians for the Commonwealth is a now 40-year or 41-year-old grassroots movement that started in eastern Kentucky with the coal miners back in the day in the 60s, I believe it was. And they pick different types of social issues to work on. They're getting big into climate now. They're into the whole rent situation, economic justice, abolition. They do a myriad of things, and they're trying to build a really more inclusive organization, nonprofit. We have big, hairy, audacious goals now to get to make KFTC even better and more inclusive for all Kentuckians. And they are just so wonderful to work with. They've been so supportive. Any little thing you do is enough, you know. So it's just been a wonderful experience. And I don't know why anybody would not want to be part of KFTC.
Sure. So you mentioned a constitutional amendment to change Kentucky law. So what's the best argument for why the state should change its approach to felon disenfranchised? And Claire, I'll start with you because you worked with someone, right, as an advocate who had been going through these various issues. So what did this experience teach you about the state's approach to felon disenfranchisement in general? And what's the arguments that we should change our approach?
I think that it can be confusing for people to figure out a way out of the situation that they've tried so hard to move on from. I think that there are many years and many ways that you try to, like, resolve the situation.
And it took a lawyer or a lawyer in training to work with someone just to, for simple things like, you know, getting an expungement of their record. You know, not everyone can go to the legal clinic. And it, I think it demonstrates the that, you know, it takes – because, as you mentioned, it's so confusing that it takes resources that perhaps are better used for other things if we,
Absolutely.
You know, simplified the law. Deb, what about you? What's your best argument for why we should have a state constitutional amendment on the state's practice of felon disenfranchisement?
Well, the number one thing is that if someone is able to vote or that's restored to them, it is proven that it helps cut down on recidivism. So, I mean, if you give somebody their right back, it makes you feel more like a whole person again, like whatever the bad thing that happened or you did in the past has been, you know, you're able to vote, so you're able to be a complete citizen, and you may even be able to be part of a movement that will help cure another ill or another bad situation that are still prevalent here in Kentucky.
Yeah. So this show is called Democracy Optimist. Mm-hmm. Are you both optimistic about democracy, given the work that you've done and what you've gone through? Claire, did this experience with working with Deb make you more optimistic about democracy, or is it, you know, not so optimistic because you saw the various hurdles and the complexities involved in the law?
I'm actually more optimistic after this experience. I think it can be daunting whenever you begin the process, but just seeing how fast it was to get all of these papers through the court system and get Deb's records expunged, I feel really optimistic that we can continue improving on our practice and on our methods. It was also a great experience to learn just how much people want to regain their right to vote.
Deb, what about you? Are you optimistic about voting in elections?
Well, when I got up this morning and turned on my computer and read that we now have four bills that are pending in the legislature right now, the fourth one was filed today, I'm very optimistic. There's still some carve-outs that are in some of the bills that are out there right now. And there's one that's pretty darn near what we would call perfect at KFTC. So, yeah, I'm optimistic that Kentucky can get past this and do something that will be positive for a whole lot of people in Kentucky.
And these are bills to change the rules on felon disenfranchisement.
Correct.
All right, here's the big question for you, Deb. Why should people vote? You know, voter turnout in a presidential election is, you know, still 60-65%. When you get to the local elections, much lower. You're someone who is denied the right to vote and has regained it. Why should people vote?
I don't know why people don't vote. I don't know why there's such apathy and such disinterest, or I get a little tired of hearing, well, my vote doesn't count. Well, when your vote's been taken away, you know how much your vote counts. Whether or not everything that you vote for or against doesn't turn out the way you want it, it's still an integral part of being a citizen of the United States. And I believe that everybody should be encouraged, and if they don't know, to get some kind of education around why it is so important to vote. And it's the only way that we can really participate in our democracy is to be part of the voting public.
Deb Greiner and Claire Sandberg, thank you for coming on Democracy Optimist to tell your story. Very inspiring. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, Josh, there have been many legal challenges to the practice of felon disenfranchisement. Tell us more about those challenges.
Yeah, advocates have argued that the policy of felon disenfranchisement violates the Voting Rights Act because a disproportionately large number of people who are disenfranchised identify as racial minorities. Courts have rejected those challenges, however, though there have been vigorous dissents. The U.S. Supreme Court has not weighed in on the question of the Voting Rights Act and felon disenfranchisement. There have also been challenges under the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, but most of those have failed as well. But there's a new case to watch. In August of last year, the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down Mississippi's felon disenfranchisement law, saying that it imposes a cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Mississippi has the highest percentage of disenfranchisement in the country at 11% of its voting age population, 59% of which are black individuals. However, the full Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals put the decision on hold while it reconsiders the issue. The full court heard oral argument in January 2024. As of the taping of this episode, we are still waiting for a ruling. But either way, this case seems likely to head to the Supreme Court in terms of whether the Eighth Amendment bars certain felon disenfranchisement laws for being cruel and unusual punishment. It's certainly one to watch.
Well, give us another of your fun election facts.
Well, maybe this one's not so fun, but it is interesting, I think. Kentucky was among the first U.S. states to formally establish felon disenfranchisement in 1792. The Kentucky Constitution then read, quote, "Laws shall be made to exclude from suffrage those who thereafter be convicted of bribery, perjury, forgery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." Now, the current version of Kentucky's Constitution, adopted in 1891, reads, "Persons convicted in any court of competent jurisdiction of treason or felony or bribery in an election or of such high misdemeanor as the General Assembly may declare shall operate as an exclusion from the right of suffrage, but persons hereby excluded may be restored to their civil rights by executive pardon." And that last sentence is why Governor Beshear was able to issue a pardon of many people's felony convictions, or at least restore the right to vote to many individuals. Now, the crimes that are classified as felonies, which, again, the state constitution says creates disenfranchisement, are plentiful, surely more than those who wrote the Kentucky Constitution likely could have imagined back then. Here are some of the crimes that you may not think of that will result in lifetime disenfranchisement unless there's an order from the governor to restore your rights. Tax crimes, theft, public intoxication, small amounts of drug distribution, property damage, forgery, using or manufacturing counterfeit gambling chips, and credit card fraud. That said, there have been bipartisan proposals in Kentucky to amend the state constitution to remove the severe felon disenfranchisement it allows.
And what's that one thing that we can do to support democracy?
Well, as I said, there's been a bipartisan push to make Kentucky not one of the most severe states when it comes to felon disenfranchisement. And so this is an issue where I think contacting your legislator to advocate for reform of felon disenfranchisement policies can make a difference. As I said, there's a bipartisan push in Kentucky to change the state constitution. Second, if you yourself do have a felony conviction, you should check to see if your rights were restored. As I said, Governor Beshear restored the right to vote to thousands of individuals, and many people don't realize that they are now eligible to vote. The Campaign Legal Center has a free confidential tool for individuals with felony convictions to find out if they're eligible to vote at restoreyourvote.org. So check it out and share the website with others. And finally, a word about language. You might have noticed that I use the term people with a felony conviction or individuals with a felony conviction instead of the word felons, and that's purposeful. I don't think it's fair to label someone for life based on the worst mistake that they made.
Coming up when we return, a successful campaign in Florida to restore the right to vote to those convicted of felonies.
We was able to center the campaign on humanity, not on our politics, not on our race, reminding it that we're everyone's son, daughter, mother, father, favorite uncle, and get people to start to think about who in your family do you love who's ever made a mistake? Do they deserve a second chance?
Desmond Mead, founder of the Florida Rights Restoration Clinic, when we return. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
We're back with Democracy Optimist, our series on voting and election law with host Josh Douglas.
They are your neighbors, your friends, maybe even your family members. 4.6 million Americans have lost their right to vote because of a felony conviction due to a policy known as felon disenfranchisement. The policy has a disproportionate impact on people of color, given our criminal legal system. While 4.6 million disenfranchised Americans is a huge number, that's down from closer to 6 million people who could not vote due to a felony conviction in 2016. And because this is a show titled Democracy Optimist, I like to focus on the good news aspects of the fight for equal voting rights and to highlight people who are doing vital work in this space. That's why I'm thrilled to welcome Desmond Mead as today's guest. Desmond started an effort in Florida through the Florida Rights Restoration Clinic to re-enfranchise 1.4 million returning citizens in the Sunshine State, known as Amendment 4. He has an incredibly powerful and compelling story. Desmond, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Josh, listen, I am honored. I'm honored to be a part of this show.
Thanks. So let's start with your own story, which is, of course, difficult, and you've bravely told it many times in public, but also shows the power of redemption. Tell us a little bit about what happened to you when you were younger.
Yes. So listen, a lot of times when I start telling my story, I always tend to start around 2005, right? So yeah, I would still consider myself a young man, but that was a very pivotal moment. I mean, I could go through the whole nine yards about, you know, being born in the Virgin Islands and really coming over to the United States and going through the family life. But I think what's more impactful is what happened in August of 2005, when I found myself standing in front of railroad tracks, waiting on a train to come so I can jump in front of them. But that day, as I stood there, I was at the bottom. I was the lowest of my lows. I was addicted to drugs. I was unemployed. I was recently released from prison, right? And didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and I was ready to end my life. I really was. Wow. And I remember when I was standing there, the main thing that was going through my head was like trying to figure out how much pain I was going to suffer or feel when that train ran over my body. You know, whether I was going to have to go through moments of excruciating pain or was I going to die instantly? And that was the dilemma I was facing when I was standing there. But, you know, I tell folks, thankfully, that train never came. And eventually I crossed those tracks and I walked a couple blocks further, checked myself into drug treatment. And after completing a 4-month in-house program, you know, I moved into a homeless shelter. And while living in the homeless shelter, I made a conscious decision to go to school. And my motivation was not necessarily, you know, to get a great job or get a bunch of degrees. My motivation was basically wanting to do something to prevent me from what we call in the industry, relapsing, right? And that's when, you know, someone may have been addicted to drugs or alcohol and they stop using and their life start to improve. And then something happens to cause them to pick up a drink or a drug. And the next thing you know, they're right back where they started from. And so I've had a lot of those cycles and I didn't want to face another cycle because I didn't know if I was going to be able to recover from that. And so that's was my motivation for going to school, to try to do something to raise my self-esteem that would prevent me from relapsing. And that's what I did. And eventually doing well in classes and end up getting a few degrees, graduating at the top of my class and eventually getting accepted into law school.
Yeah.
And in 2014, graduating with a law degree.
That's just amazing. But of course, even after you graduated and had a law degree, you couldn't sit for the bar because of your prior felony conviction, and you couldn't vote. So how did that turn into, you know, what was next for you in your work?
You know, that's a great question, Josh. You know, during in my undergraduate years, when my bachelor's degree, I majored in public safety management with a concentration in criminal justice. And through my service work, as well as through, you know, my education efforts, I discovered, you know, this thing called felon disenfranchisement, and how Florida led the nation in disenfranchising its citizens. And at the time, I think it was around like 1.54 million people that lived in Florida could not vote because of a prior felony conviction. And, you know, yeah, that number might seem small, but then when you look at it in a much broader context, that's more people than the population of about, you know, 10 states and territories. Or when you look at it globally, that's more people than the population of over like 40 countries in the world, right? 1.54 million. And so Florida accounted for about a quarter of the people in the United States that couldn't vote. And when you dug deeper and started saying, wait a minute, why not? And then in the case of Florida, it was because there were four politicians that made that decision about whether or not they can get their rights back. And so typically, once a person is convicted of any felony in Florida, they lose their rights for life, which means not only can they not vote, they can't serve on the jury, they can't run for office, right? And then they have, you know, hundreds of other collateral consequences that are attached to losing civil rights. You mentioned one of them, Josh. I couldn't sit for the bar. But the other one is, in some places, I can't even buy or even rent a home until my civil rights have been restored. Or there are other occupational licenses that I can't get. And so with that seemingly insurmountable hurdle in front of people with previous felony convictions, and then understanding that the only thing that was standing between them was four politicians, and I went back to thinking about the right to vote, and I was like, wait a minute, that's the most telling indicator of citizenship that our democracy has. The ability to vote, and to think that four politicians had that much power to determine which American citizen get to vote and which don't, I thought that was too much power for a politician to have.
Yeah.
Whether they're Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. No politician should have that power, because that leaves room for partisan politics to play a role in deciding which American citizen get to vote. And I think that everyone, whether they agree with me or not, whether we have the same philosophies or not, same skin color or not, every American citizen should be able to have an opportunity to have their voices heard and be able to vote in an election.
So you showed that through grassroots work that power shouldn't just rely or rest in four politicians, but that it should be the people themselves through this push for Amendment 4 to reform Florida's practice of felon disenfranchisement. So tell us a little bit about how the advocacy for Amendment 4 started, which did change the Florida Constitution.
Well, that's great. Well, I'll be honest, like, it started with organizations that had all of the greatest intentions of combating felon disenfranchisement. And I was introduced to these multiple organizations back in 2007, 2008, right? And, you know, they had all of the great organizations with all of the great initials, whether it was ACLU, whether it was NAACP, Brennan Center, state-based organizations and individuals. Like, there were over, I believe, 250 entities that represented a coalition of people that wanted to address felon disenfranchisement in Florida. But here was the problem. You ready for this, Josh?
Mm-hmm.
The people that were leading it, none of them were impacted.
Huh.
Right. The decision makers in those organizations, none of them were impacted. And so
meaning they all could vote, basically.
They all could vote. And so therefore, if there was a big setback or if another issue popped up, right, that seemed to be of greater importance or significance, guess what? They're going on to that one and they're leaving people like me right back here at the starting line. Because at the end of the day, you know, I can't vote. And so at some point when I realized, wait a minute, you guys can walk away anytime because you can vote. I can't walk away. And that's when I really fully understood that it was people who are most impacted by a situation that should be at the center of the movement. And when that happened, when I realized that, then I started leading that charge and I came up with this vision. No, we're going to do a ballot initiative, right? And we're going to do it. We're going to engage people's family and we're going to organize this ballot initiative around love. It was a slow pace at first and it wasn't easy. But let me tell you, I tell folks that in my car, I would drive 50,000 miles a year in my car without leaving the state of Florida, 50,000. And I'm going from nook to cranny, from top to bottom, from left to right, right, in all different cities and counties, and with a willingness to talk to anyone who would stop long enough to listen about why felon disenfranchisement is hurting the state of Florida. And we eventually did, we were able to get over 1 million petitions signed, far over the required number that we needed to get. And we was able to get on the ballot. And let me tell you, in November of 2018, you know, over 5.1 million people voted yes on Amendment 4, right? And Florida is the toughest state to pass a ballot initiative. We needed 60% to pass. We got 65%. Another significant thing, two significant things. Number one, our initiative got more votes than the governor, the person who became governor of Florida. We had more people vote yes on our initiative than the people who voted for Governor DeSantis. And then the other thing is that we had over 1 million voters that voted yes for Amendment 4 that were registered Republicans, which showed the wide cross-section of support that we have for our initiative. And I think part of that goes to that people directly impacted and leading stuff is a very powerful force. Matter of fact, they're the one in Kentucky. It's the come up named ABLE, right? Which I thought was a great acronym for the organization because in my head, I was thinking, man, everybody is not able, but anybody can be, which basically says that, yeah, everybody is not a returning citizen, right? But I promise you that everybody knows someone who's been impacted by the criminal justice system, right? And on top of that, everyone is a second away from being a returning citizen. Mm-hmm. Whether it's somebody that cuts you off in traffic and you're irate or somebody that skipped the line and you may just even just want to grab them and say, what the heck are you doing, right? Just hitting a car, right? They can be interpreted as assault. In Florida, you could get like a felony conviction for releasing helium-filled balloons in the air or even trespassing on a construction site or catching a lobster whose tail is too short, right? And so I know in Tennessee and Kentucky and in the Midwest, there are all kinds of laws that people are just a second away from committing. And some of us have broken laws. We just haven't got caught. And so I love this phrase that everybody is not a returning citizen. Everybody is not able, but anybody at any given moment can become a returning citizen. And so being able to have like that grassroots organization within the state of Florida that was led by directly impacted people, that was led by people who had no other direction to go because everybody else could still vote, but we couldn't. We was able to center the campaign on our humanity, not on our politics, not on our race, but rather on our humanity, reminding it that we're everyone's son, daughter, mother, father, favorite uncle, and get people to start to think about, you ready for this, Josh? Who in your family do you love who's ever made a mistake?
Yeah.
Do they deserve a second chance?
And do we want to be judged by the worst mistake we made and that defines who we are? No one wants that. But let me ask you this, you know, for people who are not yet there, for people who, you know, believe in this idea that, well, you broke the social contract, right? You demonstrated that you don't want to abide by society's laws, so you shouldn't have the ability to determine who makes those laws. What's your response to that kind of social contract theory?
I love that, right? Because here's the deal, right? And I think it's a perfect question for the moment that we're in. I remember the Republican primaries when they had the debates, and I remember the moderator asked the question, if Donald Trump is convicted of a felony offense, will you still support him to be president of the United States? And what happened? How many people raised their hand and said yes?
Yeah.
How many? And so I was like, I thought that was a beautiful thing. Because if you're saying that you would support somebody who's convicted of a felony being the president of the United States, then every last one of you should be supportive of someone who's convicted of a felony being able to vote for who they want to be the president of the United States. So that's one. But here's a more basic thing. I have four sons. And let me tell you, anybody with sons would tell you that boys are going to do boneheaded things. Mm-hmm. It's just in their DNA. They can't help it. And I thought about, you know, and they pick the timing of it. They all four of them do not do it at the same time. Right? So they'll never give me a rest. They'll never give me a break. And they go out there and they do something stupid. Let me tell you, and I'm upset, right? And I want to shake them. Like, what the heck were you thinking? And you know what dawned on me one day was that no matter what my son does, they never stop being my son. They never stop being my son. And I thought about like Maine or Vermont, where living in Maine and Vermont, no one ever loses their right to vote. I think about countries throughout the world, right? Even like countries like France, no one ever loses their right to vote. That is something that is connected, intimately connected to what we call citizenship. And when you lose the right to vote, it's like you're relegated to second class citizenship status. And so my sons never stopped being a Mead. So why should you stop being an American citizen because you made a mistake? This country was founded on second chance. That's what this country was founded on. And so you making a mistake does not automatically exclude you from being a part of this country. However, say it does. You're punished for your mistake. Once you served your time, when the debt is paid. Like when you pay the last car note or the last mortgage payment, you have no expectations of receiving a bill the next month in the mail. When does the punishment stop? And I'm going to tell you right now, I have yet to find anyone in the United States of America that will tell you that they don't ever want to be forgiven for anything that they've done for the rest of their lives. I mean, we even have bankruptcy law. After 7 years, you're given a clean slate. So if a person done their crime, you strip them of their rights, they serve their time, give them the rights back, let them move on. Because let me tell you, you have our country have much more to gain by restoring voting rights than we have to lose. As a matter of fact, there's nothing to lose and everything to gain.
But the story is not complete with just the passage of Amendment 4 and 65% of Florida voters saying they wanted to reform the state constitution to make it easier or to give back the right to vote after someone's done their time. Because after the amendment passed, the Florida legislature enacted a law to undo a lot of the work, requiring individuals to pay back all their fines and fees, sometimes known as legal financial obligations, before they can regain their rights. So what does that tell you in that kind of secondary fight when the legislature tried to undo a lot of the work that Amendment 4 was intending to do?
Yeah, you know, I choose my words a little carefully. I don't even say undo, because what we've done, right, we have enshrined a restoration of voting rights in our state constitution. It's never been done before. We did it. We did it. Prior to that, anyone who lost their rights, lifetime ban. The only reprieve they had was going through the governor, right, and three other politicians. That was the only reprieve that they had. What we did with Amendment 4 was create an alternative pathway so no American citizen should have to grovel at the knees of any politician to get their citizenship back. So I want to be very clear with that, that what we did is carefully and securely enshrined in our state constitution, which means if anybody wants to undo it, they have to do it constitutionally. What the legislature did was just create an obstacle or a hurdle for a person to have to go through to experience what we've guaranteed them in our state constitution. And that is literally the legislature interpreting what completion of sentence means. And it was very simple. We thought, you know, you do your time, you know, you pay your debt to society, you go ahead and go, you know, complete your sentence, go vote. The legislature say, oh, no, it's not so fast. Not only do you have to complete your time, but you have to pay all these mundane fees that we have assessed because you went to court. And that is the problem. And so it creates an obstacle, but it doesn't create an absolute bar from a person being able to vote.
Yeah. And because, you know, I'm an optimist and, you know, I called the show Democracy Optimist, I do like to point out the fact that the Amendment 4 still re-enfranchise hundreds of thousands of people, you know, who don't have these legal obligations.
Let's do the math. Amendment 4 basically enfranchised over 1.4 million people. The requirement that the legislature made law that allowed for the required the payment of fines and fees impacted 774,000 people. When I do the math, that still leaves over 600,000 people, right, that can register to vote right now in this state. And so in the state of like Florida, come on. Historically, Florida, we know 100,000, 50,000 is a margin, is their margin of victory. And it's been like that for quite a number of years. It's even gotten as low as, what, 527 votes in Bush v. Gore?
Yeah, 537, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and so 600,000 new voters is extremely significant. So this is more of a glass is half full as opposed to a glass is half empty.
Yeah. Now, we're almost out of time, Desmond, but I want to ask you before we finish up, tell us about the day when you went to vote after having restored your having your rights restored.
Wow. Let me tell you. So the first time I had the opportunity to vote after voting rights were restored, I remember walking up when I was walking up to the voting location and thinking, man, I'm walking on hollow ground, because I started thinking about the blood that was shed by so many people in this country for independence, for rights, civil rights. I thought about all of the volunteers that was collecting petitions and donating their hours in the sweltering heat and humidity of Florida to help pass this amendment, right? And I was like, man, no, I am walking on hollow ground right now. And then when I went and I got my voting card and I went into my booth, my ballot, I went to the booth, I realized that what I was engaged in was a sacred act. I walked on hollow ground to go and commit a sacred act. And it was an act that transcended above the politics, above the implicit racial biases. It took me somewhere much higher than that. I realized that I was engaging in something that didn't validate me as a Black man or as a Democrat or a Republican. It validated me as a human being within a society whose voice mattered.
Wow. What a powerful story. What a powerful story. Desmond, thank you for all of your work in this space. Desmond Mead is the director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, working to reform felon disenfranchisement policies in Florida and across the nation. Desmond, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh.
Josh, there's quite a long history behind the practice of taking voting rights away from people who are convicted of crimes. What can you tell us about that history?
It has a very long history, but it looks a lot different today than it did many years ago. The practice dates back to ancient Greece. Those who violated the social contract in ancient Greece could be subject to a loss of most citizenship rights, essentially banishment from society, termed atimia. Ancient Rome also had the practice of infamia, or a denial of public rights. But importantly, only very serious violations, murder and the like, would qualify someone for a loss of these rights. Historically, only, quote, felonies at common law counted. But now states disenfranchise people for lots of felonies. Desmond Mead told us a little bit about some of them in Florida. In fact, Florida has a list of 533 different felonies that result in a loss of voting rights. And few of those are felonies at common law, as that term was historically understood. Many people ask me why states can ban individuals with a felony conviction from voting, especially if the right to vote is a protected constitutional right. The answer is that the Supreme Court, in a case in 1974 called Richardson versus Ramirez, ruled that the U.S. Constitution doesn't prohibit felon disenfranchisement. The court claimed that Section 2 of the 14th Amendment actually allows the practice.
Now, does felon disenfranchisement vary from state to state?
It is very different across the states. Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, and Virginia used to be the states with the most severe laws in terms of disenfranchising people for life, though there have been developments in all of those states, such as Amendment 4 in Florida that we talked about, and gubernatorial executive orders in the other states. Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky, for example, restored the right to vote for all individuals who had completed their sentences, except for those convicted of violent felonies. At the other end of the spectrum, voters in Maine, Vermont, and D.C. never lose their voting rights. People in prison for a felony conviction can still vote via absentee ballot. There have been numerous legal challenges to felon disenfranchisement, with mixed success. The best avenue for reform seems to be through state legislatures, and there are bills proposed in all of these states. In Kentucky, the process requires the state legislature to certify a measure on the ballot to amend the state constitution for the voters to then decide.
And what's that one thing that we can do to support democracy?
Restoration of voting rights is really a topic that crosses party lines. Many Democrats and Republicans support giving the right to vote back at some point after someone has finished their sentence. So this is an issue where calling your state legislator can actually make a big difference. Pick up the phone or send an email and ask your state representative about their views on this issue. And learn more about the policy of felon disenfranchisement at the Sentencing Project's website, www.sentencingproject.org. Click on Issues and then Voting Rights.
Coming up when Democracy Optimist returns in 2 weeks, it might surprise you to learn that a few jurisdictions in the United States have already started using a phone app to conduct their elections, and that there's a company called Votes that's trying to revolutionize our voting system through this app by using the blockchain.
So it has been used in 5 states so far, in West Virginia, in Utah, in Colorado, in Washington State, and in Oregon.
Our guest, co-founder and CEO of Votes, Nimit Sawhney, along with Lauren Kunis, Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Vote Writers. She's looking at issues that act as barriers to voting.
If anyone goes to our website at voteriders.org/state rules, you can see a rundown of what the rules are for voting in person and by mail when it comes to ID in your state, and also see how your state stacks up to other states when it comes to how strict or how inclusive your voter ID law might be.
An app to make voting easy and convenient, and voter ID laws that for many make it a challenge to participate in elections. On the next episode of Democracy Optimist. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm your series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple and Spotify. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.